The market is so underserved that the tide is rising, and we just need to get a, you know, a vessel that doesn't leak onto that tide and then rise with
it. Welcome to episode 73 of the Frank Online Marketing Show. My name is Tema Frank, and I'm your host. I always love it when I actually get to do some of these interviews face-to-face. Most of them I do over the phone or by Skype. While I was at eTail Canada, I had the great pleasure of meeting Jamie Clark, who says his job title before he co-founded the company Live Out There, his job title was professional adventurer, and Dave Nagy, who is his e-commerce head. This company is a fascinating company out of Calgary, very much driven by Jamie's past as a professional adventurer, having climbed Everest a couple of times. And you'll hear in the interview that that passion for the outdoors and for inspiring Canadians to get outdoors really, really drives what they do. I'm sure you will find lots of interesting stuff in this interview. It was a great delight to chat and laugh with them. It's a fairly lengthy interview, so I'm not going to spend a lot of your time with a long intro. So sit back, enjoy, and I will chat with you very briefly at the end.
My name's Jamie Clark, and I have a background as a professional adventurer, which is a sort of a strange job and a weird title. But about 11, 12 years ago, I started a store with my business partner in Calgary, a bricks and mortar store in Calgary, selling the product that I would use on my adventures, and those were primary mountain adventures. Selling the product that, you know, the down jackets, the woolly base layers that were either unavailable or we just wanted to have our own store to gain better access. And that bricks and mortar store ran wonderfully. And when we began to examine opening more stores, expanding the business, we just were unable to avoid the opportunity and scalability of e-commerce. And thus began quite some research nearly 4 years, well, more than 4 years ago, it was more like 6 years ago that we began then thinking, what's the story with this internet? And we should maybe sell stuff online. And then that was the beginning of liveoutthere.com. Okay. And my business partner and I, George Achilios, began researching it. And 4 years ago, along with Dave's help, and one other young gentleman in Calgary, the four of us, and really Dave, George, and Drew launched it, and I sort of dabbled on the sides and offered money and encouragement while I was still off doing adventures and so forth.
So how were you funding your adventures?
Through sponsorship, investment from large corporations. So, in fact, that's how my business relationship with my business partner began. More than 20 years ago, sadly much more than 20 years ago, but wonderfully at the same time, George Achilios was attending University of Calgary, getting a business degree, and I was slip-sliding around trying to figure out a proper business plan to warrant companies investing in my expeditions to the Himalaya in particular and Mount Everest.
So how did you convince them? What was the rationale for them supporting that?
Well, at first I didn't convince them well until George and I really sat down and kind of combined his business enthusiasm with my passion for these expeditions and his business know-how, and then we really sat down and built business plans where we could look at a return on investment. Mm-hmm. Up until that point, it was mostly just sort of, hey, isn't this a great idea? Wouldn't you want to give this some money to us? And the answer was no. A lot of the time. And there were so many other better causes for people, companies to give their money to, philanthropic donations in the community, to a children's hospital.
Sure.
Why spend $100,000 on a bunch of morons going to climb Mount Everest?
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I should speak for myself. I shouldn't say that about the rest of my team. An idiot going to climb Mount Everest. And so, and that made a lot of sense. That money should be given away. That should, sponsorship and donation should be, you know, philanthropic. Investment then meant we needed to give a return.
Mm-hmm.
And that return, and it came, depended on the company. We had to research the industry they were in. We had to research the company. It was a long sales process. It might take 8 months to sell a company on the idea of investing in your expedition.
Mm-hmm.
And then the return might come in. I know I can think of all sorts of examples, specific examples. One company was interested because their HR program had a health improvement strategy, in particular a smoking cessation effort, and they wanted to use Everest, at least we talked them into using Everest as a metaphor for health improvement. Mm-hmm. Another company wanted to use it as a sales rallying point, which makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. They were building the company, trying to do some very ambitious things, you know, quadrupling their sales in the next 2 years. So they had this Everest that they were trying to climb from a sales perspective. And, you know, mountains lend themselves to one's profit and loss chart.
Right.
And so we used these metaphors. And then as we became more sophisticated with it, it worked out really, really, really well where, you know, you surround your team, you manage risk, you know, you have setbacks in the weather. There's lots of really powerful analogies that you can pull. And in some cases, really entertaining and interesting analogies, dramatic analogies of the adventure and related to business. And it ended up being a 20-year, 25-year run of a handful of expeditions well-funded by great companies. And that's how the business relationship that George and I began. We'd been friends since grade six, so we were buddies for a long time before that. So with his help, we became quite successful raising money to underwrite expeditions. Hmm. And I'm very lucky to have that kind of experience.
Yeah.
And then we thought, well, we work well together and enjoy it. Let's do something. And then we were crazy enough to start the store, the bricks and mortar. I'm making this a long story, but I'll shut up very quickly.
That's okay.
So we did the bricks and mortar store. That seemed to work out okay. Mm-hmm. And I think both of us have an entrepreneurial bend.
Yeah.
I really like having seeing something and then creating it from nothing. And I've been very well served by my adventure experiences because in business there's a lot of risk management, there's a lot of unknown, there's a lot of fear and worry. Mm-hmm. You know, on the side of a mountain, you're worried about your life, but when you run a business, you're worried about people's livelihoods.
Right.
And that's pretty intense. Mm-hmm. It's nice to know you're probably not going to die any given day, you know, selling down jackets online. So that makes it a little bit more relaxing.
Yes.
Although some days you might want to punch yourself in the face, but,
yes.
You know, generally speaking. So, long story short, we then went out with our somewhat polished skills at raising money, launched our store, became successful, wanted to expand, saw e-commerce as the way to go. Mm-hmm. We're very lucky to be able to attract someone like Dave Nagy, who we then shared our vision with, and he believed it. And then for at least the first few months, Dave was so enthusiastic, he just did it, you know, pro bono. Like, I believe in what you guys are doing, and there's a great opportunity here, and I want to work with you. And, you know, worked with us for free, shockingly, which is a very
strong demonstration. And why did you do that, Dave?
Demonstration.
Well, it was I had become infatuated with startups. I've had about a 12-year career in digital marketing to date. And it was about 6 or 7 years into that that I started to really be attracted to startups. And we coming out of Calgary, it's not necessarily the greatest startup incubator, but there were a few interesting things happening at the time. So when I had the opportunity to meet George and Jamie, it was, you know, certainly a vertical that I was passionate about. And these guys were pretty enthusiastic and charming gentlemen. Did a pretty good sell job. And so I was convinced. I was hooked. And I think part of the experience for me, I'll give you one great story, you know, so the epiphany that I had would have been when Jamie was doing kind of his last Everest expedition, and George and Drew Gilson and I had the opportunity to trek into base camp. And I think one of the profound moments that happened there was the day when Jamie was on the summit, and George and Drew and I were, you know, down in a valley, I think in Lobiche, and Jamie was in such good shape, and the conditions were so good, he was able to radio down off the mountain and talk to the three of us. Now, as Jamie had said earlier, the three of us had kind of worked on the website for the past 4 to 6 months. I'm not even too sure how long it was at that point, and it was, you know, modestly successful. I don't think we really weren't making money or anything yet at that point.
But we were selling stuff. You guys were doing a good job.
Yeah, we were, you know, we were doing the best we could, and not having, you know, a lot of know-how about what we were trying to achieve at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just being there in the Himalayas and, you know, having Jamie at the top of the mountain radio down to us and say our names and speak to us about what he's experienced up there is a real profound moment, I think, in the history of Live Out There. Mm-hmm. It was certainly validated why we were there and kind of set us off on this new adventure of what was about to become.
Interesting.
Now at that point, if we could only figure out how to sell gear, that was the question.
It did mark the end of my that high altitude adventuring career and the transition to, okay, boys, now all four of us are going to go after this thing.
Yeah.
Like, you'd undertake a Himalayan expedition with that, you know, singularity of purpose. And
you could feel the energy at that exact moment. That's what was happening right there. So.
That's cool. Yeah. So what was it like for you doing the summit thing?
You didn't get to explain how you got here. You're being very modest. But anyway,
oh, okay.
Which is Dave, typical Dave Nagy, so I'll shut up. But
there was nothing death defying.
Oh. Hey, I'm curious.
Well, Dave's actually had a wonderful back. I mean, you're being modest, but you came to the team with experience with big brands and success with those brands. But I think you were enamored, interested in starting something from very grassroots, right, and then having that autonomy as a marketing guy to and have that full responsibility, as heady as it's been at times, I would think.
I had shunned the ad agency model at that point and kind of branched on my own several years previous to be a consultant in this space, and had decentralized, I kind of dubbed myself the decentralized ad agency, and plucked resources from around the world to build big interactive things, and in a lot of cases oversold those opportunities to organizations that were much larger than me.
Right.
And of course those are stressful things to manage, and it was hard learnings but exciting at the same time. So you're doing things that you never imagined that you would do in your career. But at the same time, going through 4 or 5 years of running that consultancy, I think I always wanted to get a little bit more grassroots, right? I mean, that's where startup really became attractive to me, and working with a good group of people and something you can affect every day.
Well, that's the thing, when you're a consultant, you're giving advice, but it may or may not be implemented or done right.
That's right. All the wisdom that I can impart doesn't necessarily help General Motors change their bottom line,
Right.
So when you're such a small cog and such a big instrument, it's often defeating. So what I like about being part of a company like Live Out There is that you have an impact every single day in what you do. So,
right.
And you get to share that with the people that are around you. So,
and you have to do it every single day.
Every single day.
Or else.
7 days a week.
24/7. Yeah. That's what he was telling me last night.
Yeah.
24/7.
Of all our departments, Dave has, in terms of our hiring, is one department that has been mostly neglected, almost to Dave's fault, because he's good at what he does. And when you're so good at something, you're just like, oh, well, Dave, you can do it all. Which has been, a blessing and a curse. Because
on the bright side, it's not pro bono anymore.
Yeah. It's marginally not pro bono. Okay? We finally did have a salary kick, unrelated, but that was 3 years overdue.
It's a startup, right? Yeah.
I'm frugal, but not cheap.
Right. Okay. Got it.
So what it was like being on the summit? It was obviously tremendous. The first, I've been fortunate enough to go twice. I've had 4 expeditions to Everest in particular, and twice to its summit, dating back from my first trip there in 1991 when I was just a young boy, a young man, and then going there again. I think the second time, having gone there, I had a much deeper appreciation for the experience.
Really?
I savored it much more than I did the first time. I was much more patient in the unfolding. And I knew also there was this building sense with the guys and culminating that moment on the summit that this was going to mark the end of that career for me. And not to make some fancy sporting analogy, because mountain climbing and professional sport have very little crossover, but it was almost like you were winning the championship. You were going to win this championship, and you knew it was your last game,
right,
that you were going to play, and you were going to go out in game 7 of the Stanley Cup with the win.
Way to go, Ray Poor.
Yeah, that's right. And not that this should make that analogy, because maybe that's maybe making my situation sound too glorious, but in my own little way, that's what it felt like. But there was also this sense of afterward, if you've spent your whole life focused on that particular kind of lifestyle, you can't just turn that off.
Okay.
And you can come back from that and then struggle and be a bit lost.
Right.
Not to liken it to astronauts either, but I found it interesting to hear some of the struggles of astronauts after they have accomplished great things. And then, I literally have to come back to Earth and walk on its surface and maybe find that a little bit dull in comparison to...
So you've got to grow the Hatfield mustache.
Yes, and there's one man who seems to be doing it very gracefully. Yeah. So in a very small way... climbing or having that, when you have any kind of major focus and then it's over, regardless of how it turns up, triumph or tragedy, there's a transition. But like to Dave's point, I didn't have that because there we were. There was this team already awaiting me, and they're ready to welcome me back, and this new project. And to pour all that same focus and passion that made us successful running expeditions and climbing, we now have duplicated in our entrepreneurial efforts to run liveoutthere.com, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me about what made you feel you could be competitive in that space. I mean, we've already got big players like Mountain Equipment Co-op and other online retailers who do sell the sporting goods and the adventure stuff. Sure. Why did you think that you could compete successfully, and how are you doing that?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things that are working in our favor in Canada. We have an e-commerce industry that is very...
In its infancy.
Yeah, it's, I was looking for the right word for it. It's a huge opportunity in Canada. So, and that works for us. I wish we could sit here and say we are the absolute geniuses of e-commerce, and we're out there stealing market share all day long because we're just so good. That, I hope we steal a little market share along the way. We are establishing a market. And that is a different fight, for certain, but it's an easier battle.
Okay.
So we have that working for us, and that is that there are, albeit there is a Mountain Equipment Co-op that does a fabulous job, of both with its bricks and mortar and its online effort, there are other competitors in the country who are growing. But the market is so underserved. Mm-hmm. That the tide is rising, and we just need to get a vessel that doesn't leak onto that tide and then rise with it. Mm-hmm. So we have that benefit. So the market factors, in that this is an underserved market, 70% of Canadians would like to buy online, 17% of companies, we spoke about this last night, offer a viable e-commerce option. There's a problem there, and we are solving it, along with the rest of our Canadian e-commerce businesses.
Right.
And so that helps us. In outdoor active lifestyle, there's an interesting dynamic with the Frizzani Group and Sport Check and some of our competitors where e-commerce isn't necessarily on their radar as it is for us. Mm-hmm. So that gives us an opportunity. And I think on top of all of that, we have, unlike MEC, for example, we offer brands that Canadians are interested in. We sell Arc'teryx, a Canadian company, by the way, which is arguably one of the best hard shell manufacturers in the world, hands down, and a company and a brand Canadians should be very, very proud of. Hmm. If you and I were going off to climb a Himalayan peak and we had all the money in the world and we could pick any gear we wanted, Arc'teryx would make up the vast majority of the stuff we took with us. So that says a lot about that company. So we know the brands very, very well. The Arc'teryxes, the Mountain Hardwares, the Icebreakers, the Marmots, and the list can go on forever. So we have a lot of very specific product knowledge and wisdom. Mm-hmm. We are helping serve an underserved market. And I think we have, and to be boastful, a great team. Dave Nagy is damn good at driving traffic, the right traffic, to our site. And our team is getting better and better at offering that traffic what they need and creating a conversion and running a business.
And let's not undersell the value of this first ascent, right? It's not easy what we're doing. I think even though we believe there's a lot of market share and a good runway for us still in Canada, we've got great mentorship examples that we can take out of the U.S. with brands that have done it well in a mature marketplace like backcountry.
Right.
But this first ascent, this trailblazing that we're doing, is not necessarily easy either. Just because there is space there, I think the hard thing maybe for us to rationalize is just how difficult it has been.
So what are some of the challenges? What makes it so difficult?
People, probably at the top of that list, finding skilled resources. We live out there, is based in Calgary, which is, it's a great city to be based in if you're in this particular vertical and you believe in the kind of things that we do.
Yes.
So philosophically, it's a match for us in Calgary, but it's also one of the toughest resource towns in the country. Mm-hmm. So you'll pay more for technical resources.
You'll have a smaller pool
to pick from,
of
course. And the opportunities, the job market in Calgary is so hot. Every year, I've been in the city for 12 years. Jamie, you're born and raised in Calgary. I've never seen a soft job market in Calgary.
Yeah. So.
Other than the crashes that occur. So what's interesting that we've been able to do, though, is although we can't maybe pay the salaries that those big oil and gas firms do, we don't have the monstrous benefit packages. We have, because of what we're doing and the interest in it, we're able to recruit and attract really great people who are coming to work with us for more reasons than just that paycheck.
Right.
We believe inside of our company that when you think of compensation, you really have a list of 10 or 12 things that you can offer someone.
Okay.
Obviously, there are lifestyle things. Mm-hmm. There are, if I believe trying to attract someone to a team, you need to pay them reasonably, but you also need to give them the tools to do their job. That makes sense.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised how often that does not happen.
Yeah.
Offering someone who's good at what they do the autonomy and responsibility to actually do it and to jump in there and be held accountable, although terrifying for many, is very rewarding from a career perspective. So we in a small company, when you come and work with us, you sit in the room with the decision makers. George and Drew and Dave and I, we lead the direction of our company every day. Mm-hmm. And we're small enough at 25-ish, and although we'll be soon 35-ish, and long after that, 45-ish. But we still are very intimately connected with the day-to-day operation and have built a team of great folks who are really excited about what we're doing. Because I think the what is as important as the why.
Yeah.
And why are we building this company? And we believe that we're building it not just to build a great company, which we really want to, not because we want to just be paid well and give return to our investors, which, yes, we very much want to. Why? Because we live in this fantastic country that I believe, and having traveled around the world, I hope my opinion means something, this is one of the world's great playgrounds that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
A very small population. We have a very harsh environment indeed, which means you need lots of great gear. But we have a mission to inspire Canadians to go and play in this playground that we call Canada.
Right.
Whether that's a park that is 4 minutes from your home or you travel across the country, we have some of the most amazing and rugged geography on the planet, unpopulated.
Yeah.
Some amazing national and provincial parks. And we want to inspire Canadians to throw on a nice, cute, well-shaped, well-built jacket and grab your kids and go walk your dog. Or we want you to plan your family vacation on mountain biking across Prince Edward Island or whatever it is. We really have a mission in our company to want to inspire people to get outside. TV programs are fascinating. There's great stuff to watch. Video games, considering I played Pong when I was a kid, are mind-blowing today.
Yeah.
There's an enormous amount of inertia that you have to get over to get your lazy butt off the couch, because I can, too, sit there and be mind-numbingly entertained with my kids playing video games, with my wife, you know, watching 4 episodes of Breaking Bad. Like, if we're not disciplined, we will stay there for days.
Yes.
We want to get people out of there. Those are great shows. Those are great video games. Play a little, not a lot.
Right.
The average North American is watching over 4.5 hours of television.
Yeah, that blows my mind. How do they manage? I don't even have a TV anymore.
I don't watch that. I watch, you know, I get stuck watching The Voice because my wife loves it. But, you know, and I you know, endear that for a good relationship. But and pretend that, oh, aren't they a great singer?
She's going to hear this.
As she knows this, she'll kick me under the table. I'm not watching that. You know, if it's a half hour a day, it's a lot for me. So
yes.
Who's making up my 4 hours that I'm not?
Right.
And that's just appalling.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get out and be active. Go walk your dog, man. Get off the couch. And that's why at the heart of what we're doing is really important. I think any company needs to know why they're in business. Not just what we're doing, but why. And obviously we understand profitability, but there's much more important things than that. Once you meet that baseline, hey, we're a profitable company, everybody's getting paid, we're making a reasonable return for everybody's investment, now what?
Mm-hmm.
We need to make a contribution. So to Dave's point, it's very difficult to find the talent, but when we're able to sit with that talent and explain, we're looking for people that our why resonates with
right.
them. You want to be part of something.
Yeah.
And if you believe in what our mission is, then you can be part of our company.
In terms of the bricks and mortar versus the online store, how do you think the customers are different, and how does that, how does one build off the other?
We've really deviated the two. I think
okay.
in the early days of Live Out There, it was a fairly symbiotic relationship. I think probably for the first few seasons, we were selling store inventory.
We were.
The first
yes.
season,
we basically
sure.
put our store on sale to
yeah.
get sales history.
That's
okay.
right. Right?
So,
to see what
that
people buy online, I don't know what
that's right.
Yeah.
You
got to
start
right.
somewhere, right?
Exactly.
So, of course, there's this wonderful, rich history of you know, selling retail right in downtown Calgary that we had to leverage. That can make life a little bit more difficult as you go nationally and don't necessarily know how to purchase appropriately for everybody in this vast nation of ours.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that was certainly the right market entry point for Live Out There. Then we evolved that into having supplier data feeds, which was cumbersome, a lot of data management, a lot of technology resources that are required to get all these data feeds coming in from suppliers, but allowed us to grow our SKU count.
So tell me more about that. What are those data feeds?
You take a brand, like a supplier brand like the North Face, and they've got real-time inventory in their warehouses, and we, of course, didn't have the clout or the real estate or the purchasing power. We didn't even have a space for 2 years. We were working out of a coffee shop.
That was nice. That was fun.
It wasn't like a big warehouse or anything that we started with. It was a very bootstrap mode, and that was our proof of concept phase. We weren't really willing to overinvest. Jamie certainly didn't want to put in more at that point.
We need to know we had
high risk. So we need to know that we could trust and believe this thing. We've always, despite our growth curve, we've always operated pretty intelligently and you know, pretty scrappy, pretty bootstrap mode throughout the first several years for sure. So we would evolve that, you know, out of store inventory into supplier warehouse feeds, which grows your SKU count so you can show a lot of product on the website. You just don't have it on hand.
Okay.
So your customer service metrics then are going to fall a little bit because shipping times are drawn way out and you don't always have accuracy of inventory. So there would be instances where, well, we sold something we didn't have because somebody else's data feed suggested we were able to sell that. Mm-hmm. Those aren't things that are always managed in real time, of course, right? So the next evolution of the business, which has been more recent, is to up our purchasing and up our SKU count through brand acquisition. We've grown to brands by probably about 25 brands.
Okay.
And severed warehouse feeds. So we own everything that we sell. Everything that you see on our website now is right in our own headquarters in our warehouse, and we pick and pack it literally within 60 minutes in most cases.
Okay.
So customer service, our metrics have gone through the roof. Our net promoter score is 84. So it's Apple-esque. We sit right in between Apple and Zappos on the NPS score scale.
Nice.
Jamie said the opportunity to speak to customer age over in Europe to try and explain how we achieve that number,
because
it's quite baffling to a lot of organizations that have been doing this for a long time.
How do you get an NPS score like that?
So I mean, we're doing something right. I think.
So what is it that you think is driving that score?
I won't speak out of turn. I think it comes all the way back to what we were just talking about.
The depth of vision.
If that notion of what we're trying to do, the why, is authentic.
Yeah.
And I think if you're going to come work with us, when we do the interviewing process, the executive team is still very involved, and we will continue to make that effort. I don't want to walk the hall of our offices ever when we have 60 employees and wonder who that is.
Right.
I want to know who that is. And that's a lot of time to invest. But if we're doing any sort of even remotely key hires, I realize I can't dabble in some warehouse hiring, and my team there would be frustrated with that. But you know, we need to be involved in that. So when we're talking to someone and hiring them, first we just try to share with them the vision, and then I personally try to talk them out of coming to work with us, because I really want to test them on wanting to be there. I tell them really what it's like, and I really want them to think twice about it, and I want to get them to be able to feed back to me, no, Jamie, I really want this job.
Okay.
Because I think we have to mutually be lucky to have each other.
Right.
And so if we've established that, and we're clear that they understand what our vision is, then at any given moment when you're dealing with a customer now, it manifests in the why.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's remember why we're doing this. And that customer then, you're trying to inspire and enable them to go out and be active, and it's in your mind.
Right.
So you're going to really take care of that customer, because that's why we're here. Mm-hmm. And I think whether you're packing a box in the warehouse, whether you're in purchasing trying to find the right product for that person in the first place, whether you're, you know, designing a curated landing page for that person to come, and you want to make it aspirational, and you want to, you know, present the product in a way that makes sense, sizing charts, all the way through, you're trying to inspire and enable. And that helps us build this great score, I believe, all the way to that person in our customer service department who is writing an email, who is talking to someone on the phone. You know, the tone of our communication, I think that sits at the heart of it.
Okay.
And people feel that. Our customers get a sense of it, those who care. Some want, you know, just want that product because they want that product, or we happen to have a nice little promotion that goes with it. But I believe, you know, good customer scores like that don't come with one thing.
Right.
It's hundreds of things that you do, and you improve it not just with one thing, but you improve it with hundreds of things. That would be my answer.
Very fair. No, I think it's just adherence to the vision, and in our core, we're good Canadian kids too, and we're very respectful of the people that do business with us. We sincerely care about what we're doing and what we're delivering to people. It's not a facade. You know,
right.
We're not And we're not 100% capitalist, we're certainly...
Yeah, very close to it, but we're not 100%.
About 3% goes a long way.
Yeah, 3% of being good people. Not that capitalists are bad people, but greed can mess with your brain.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I think also we often talk about, we make rules in our company for our customers, not for the people who break rules, but for the people who are believe or just honest. You're out... You know, fraud is an issue. You know, people will use product and send it back. Ah, oh, it was no good. They clearly, you know, climbed Everest in these boots. But you end up.
So
maybe,
how do you deal with that kind of thing?
Yeah, you. Well, we don't have the ability at this point, just in terms of our size, to just be taking everything back willy-nilly. And even if we were bigger, I think you do have to have some respect that's reciprocal, thank you, good word. Yeah. That's reciprocal with your customer. Like when a customer is really trying to work you over, then, you know, our team can escalate it and you get on the phone with them. I've jumped on the phone with customers and I'll say, hey, come on, man. This is a little bit, you and I both know this is a little unfair. And some customers, maybe it's just not a good fit. Mm-hmm. Maybe they should go and buy something from a different company because there's not that right alignment.
Yeah.
You know, we deal with it by just sort of taking care of them as best we can, and then when push comes to shove, we will shove back a little bit and say, hey, that's come on, that's untoward, that is unfair. You know it and I know it.
Mm-hmm.
And if that person is just really angry about it, then maybe you'll lose that customer, but not all, you don't want...
Well, given your high net promoter scores, obviously,
you've
had it pretty well.
Small percentage. Yeah, we don't have it a lot. So we think, you know, that person is your buddy you're trying to take care of, who's not trying to, you know, take advantage of you.
Right. Yeah.
And that's how we try to approach it.
There's a lot of proactive things that have to go into preventing reactions, essentially. So if you do a lot of things in terms of acquisition, customer handling, and communication proactively, you find a lot fewer disputes.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I think if you're communicating shipping times, for example, that'd be a really, really soft example. If you're communicating return policies, putting return labels in boxes, setting these expectations at every step of the road about what kind of services you're delivering, it certainly leaves far fewer open-ended questions to...
Right,
to
and no surprises. Disputes. You really try...
People hate surprises.
Right.
We like to think that we like surprises, and I do maybe my birthday, but I don't like my, you know, consumer decisions to be surprises necessarily.
Right.
So we like to set certain expectations there.
And we know that by being really honest about what's happening, you can maybe lose the sale because someone is... You see the sales process where you see all the good, and then once you get committed to the sale, then the company starts bringing out all the problems, or, oh, that's not involved, or that. And there's all these add-on complications.
Mm-hmm.
And you try to... We just don't want to do that to our customer. We want to be very clear along the way, because we're really thinking about, we want to build this company. We want to build a great company, but we want to build it over time. We want you to be a customer of ours for years.
Mm-hmm.
If what we have is not what you need, we need to get you what you need, and maybe that comes from a competitor. Maybe that's... But in the long term, we want to help you get what you need to get outside and go be active.
Mm-hmm.
Sooner or later, we will win you over and sell you something. We know that just because of what we offer. And if it's not today, it's sooner or later, we believe, going to win you as our customer.
Mm-hmm.
So even though our score is great, we're still on it like a bad stink. You know, we still have a passionate customer service team. You know, if we're in the 80s, how do we stay on top of this and make it better?
Right. When you started the online store, did you find initially, and do you still find, that most of your online business is also from sort of the Calgary area, people who would experience the store, or is it
no?
Early on, it was certainly the hub for us. A lot of brand recognition, a lot of integration with the store, our bricks and mortar store at that time. Today, we have a bit of a stronger market in Western Canada. Our Eastern market is growing more, you know, far more rapidly than our Western market is. We have a lot of footprint to gain in Eastern Canada.
Yeah.
So those are obviously target markets for us. But it has really distributed itself across the country. We ship to every town and nook of the entire country. Our northern business is tremendous because they need great gear. I mean, we sell gear that'll save your life, right? So when you're in harsh conditions in that harsh climate, per capita, people spend a little bit more money and have a higher average order value up north than they will anywhere else. So.
Higher conversion rates, too.
Yeah.
And we have not noticed any cannibalization of our bricks and mortar business.
Right. No,
the store didn't take a beating once we launched online. There are we do have Calgary people who will come to our store who now will shop online and wonderfully, you know, knock mm-hmm. yourself out. That's great.
Yeah.
But we have not. Our bricks and mortar business has grown simultaneously. Obviously not at the ridiculous three-digit growth that
right,
we had on
the line. Yeah.
You know, thank goodness
yeah,
for that.
Thank God. Wow, if I could, man, we'd blow up. You know, you want, you know, 5-7% growth in the store, and, you know, we're 105% online. So we haven't noticed any problems with the store. In fact, it's improved our store business because people even in Calgary or in outlying areas who didn't even know we had the store.
Right.
It's also helped us tremendously with our suppliers because we're selling more of their stuff.
Right.
And now we have a buying group that helps us put pressure on them for more promotion, and we're just an overall bigger and better business for them.
How do you deal with the costs of shipping, particularly if you're doing a lot to up north where it's long and far?
That's a great conundrum for us.
I think for us, shipping is a big cost item, and we look at it. My gosh, we look at it. But there's two realities. One, that if you think, you know, free shipping over a cart of over $100, mm-hmm. well, that's pretty much 99.5% of our carts are well over $100.
At the time we made the decision to go fully free shipping and free returns, I think we're looking at about 8% of transactions.
That were under
$99.
Okay. Yeah. And our carts continue to grow. And I think we're basically offering it anyway. We wanted to offer Canadians a sense of comfort about because if it's your first online purchase, because remember, we're not stealing market, we're creating market primarily. So let's assume that this person has never bought online.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of barriers for that person. You need to help them go through. They got to put their credit card. I know it sounds crazy, but this is where we are in Canada.
Yeah.
10, 11 years behind patterns in e-commerce in America, and even the UK is sort of between yeah. Canada and the US. And so understanding that person, how do we make them feel comfortable about doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And one of those things is, hey, if this is not what you want, you send it back. If
right.
it just doesn't turn your fancy when you open the box, whether it's fit or color or just you don't like it, send it back.
Mm-hmm.
Take care of it, you know, don't
yeah.
run around in the mud with it and then send
right.
it back. So we wanted people to be comfortable with that. So that first hurdle was, wow, I got to pay to get this thing shipped to me and I might not like it. No problem, we'll pay for the shipping. Mm-hmm. We added to that free returns as well
yes.
as part of that.
Right.
Now, if you look at shipping expense as just a shipping expense, it's too big of a percentage. I think you have to look at shipping expense as a marketing expense as well.
Mm-hmm.
It has to look at it, here's a pure shipping, but here's a marketing expense.
Right.
And when you can break that number down to how do you bust up that percentage, it's hard to decide, but free shipping and returns for us is a marketing expense and a customer service expense as well.
Right.
Now, what we can do then is grow and really hold to task, you know, our shipping partners, putting a lot of pressure on the Canada Post, for example, to be better.
Right.
And they need to be better in this country, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, they do a hell of a job of getting our packages to very remote and ridiculous
yes.
regions. This is a tough country to ship in.
Yes.
We're a monstrous geography,
yeah.
second largest in the world, with a population of California.
Yeah.
It is tough to mm-hmm. ship in this country. So hats off to Canada Post for getting it done, because they are the last mile. You partner with FedEx and all these other couriers all day long, but the last mile in some remote community, they're handing it over to Canada Post to do the heavy lifting and getting that through the snowstorm. We believe it's not only a shipping expense, it's a marketing and customer service expense.
That's a good way to look at it, actually. That is a really good way to look at it. So what have been some of the other challenges as you've been building this thing? So you've got obviously learning about what will sell online and what won't. Were there any surprises in that?
Yeah, definitely.
Like
Canada's pretty diverse, and I think that's probably a process that we're still learning a lot about. You know, Quebecois
right.
don't buy the same stuff that we do to go
yeah.
adventuring in the Rocky Mountains, and I think that's probably the first perspective shift.
Do you have a French version of your site?
We don't,
okay.
actually. So again,
which is really on our list.
Yeah.
I'm actually French Canadian, so I'm 50% French Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents are from Quebec.
Okay.
And it's embarrassing to us that we don't have it.
Yeah.
But there's so many things on our site till this day that we don't have that you look at them. You know, people say, wow, your site's fantastic. All we see are all the
yes.
things we haven't done.
Yeah,
of course.
And a French site is one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And to Dave's point, you know, if you live in Prince Edward Island, you need different gear than you need if you live in Edmonton.
Of course.
And we're still learning how to understand what the whole country needs.
Yeah.
And that was, I don't know if that was, I guess we didn't even think of that, or we did think of it. It seems so obvious now, talking about it.
Yeah.
We probably had no clue.
Right.
But there were so many things we had no clue about. You think you're going to launch a site, right? If the software is free, it's very easy to open up a website. You know, turn on a little e-commerce, throw a little Magento in there. Shit, do it all in WordPress and make it all go and make the thing happen. That's easy. That's not the barrier to entry.
Right.
The barrier to entry is having the relationships with the suppliers where you can actually get the product to sell online.
Yeah. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Well, if you and I, this is the interesting thing about this, is that if you and I had $500 million that then we're just sitting here thinking, what should we do? We should do some e-commerce in Canada. Why don't we sell active lifestyle stuff in Canada? You could approach all sorts of manufacturers and they wouldn't sell you.
Why?
It's an interesting dynamic that goes on in Canada. You need to have earned... You think they would sell anybody, right? You make down jackets, and I want to sell your down jackets online. You think you'd give me those down jackets all day long.
Right.
Not the case. The companies who make the down jacket want to understand how you're going to deal with their brand, how you're going to present it.
Mm-hmm.
And e-commerce has had this sense, you know, you've gone to buy something online because it's on sale. It's a flash site. It's it's a discount. It's a coupon offering. That's how it really, you know, got started.
Mm-hmm.
But what with the transition we're going through right now is Canadians aren't necessarily going online anymore just because they think it's a great deal. They're going there because of selection and convenience.
Absolutely.
And we're making that transition now.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to the brand, they're kind of worried, really? You're going to go? I don't even know you. You've never had a bricks and mortar. I don't know what kind of operator you are.
Yeah.
So big deal. You've got a big, fat investment fund that you want to throw at this business, and you can hire all these people. I'm not just going to hand over to you our season, even if you place a big order with us, because I can't trust that you're going to treat our brand well. And that might not be the case in every vertical, but in the active lifestyle, particularly in the outdoor, the Arc'teryxes, the North Faces, the Marmots, the Mountain, and you know, bless them for it, but they care about what happens to their brand, and they're not just going to let anybody sell it. That's why I think our 10 years of being in bricks and mortar retail, to George, our partner's credit, he's a great operator and has tremendous respect in the industry. You know, the guy's sharp. You know, we pay our bills. We take care of their brand.
Mm-hmm.
We're the door that they want to be a part of, and so that's a struggle in the first place just to get the product you want to sell.
Right.
Unless you want to do Zappos and go buy it retail from some other store to get started and sell it online.
Well, I mean,
which is genius to get your thing going.
Well, that's what I'm thinking.
Right.
It's a way of testing out what the demand is there for.
So if you and I have that money,
is small in Canada. I think the Zappos example is great when you have some kind of robust market to do it in, so you can actually glean enough data from it to make it valuable. And
good
I would think
point.
Our data set certainly early on was, but I remember days in the early parts of the business where we'd be throwing high fives and calling each other after two or three orders went through. Right? It was a pretty exciting time. So it's pretty tough to trust your data.
Right. Yeah.
Two people bought something today.
It must be popular.
Legitimate. That doesn't happen every minute. We've got a problem. Today,
sample size for us would, I would say in certain categories, certain brands still be a problem today, even though we're selling, thousands of percentage increase over where we were back in those days, but it's still often not enough data to make larger purchasing decisions and whatnot. So
okay.
This is a viability problem in Canada there that I think, historically between that and shipping has actually scared U.S. firms like Zappos out of doing business in Canada, because they just can't deliver that same level of service.
Which is great, because it gives Canadians a chance to build these companies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I hope Canadians don't build these great companies and then just sell them off to the first U.S. Company that courts us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We want to build a great company. We want to keep a Canadian. We want to build, don't get me wrong, if we have some ridiculous situation that we can't avoid, but we want to build a great company in Canada and keep it in Canada and keep it owned by Canadians and run by Canadians and have Canadians employed in it. That's our long-term vision for this thing. And it is very difficult. So to your point, you have to source the product, which is not just a slam dunk. Secondly, you have to drive the right traffic. When you think, well, that's easy, we'll turn on a website and people will come. Build it and they will come. No, they won't.
Right.
Because they're going elsewhere.
Yeah.
There's so much other distraction. So you need a guy, a person like Dave Nagy, who can get out there and find that appropriate traffic. And not just any traffic. Traffic that is interested in what we're selling, and then channel them through the site to the right places so that they can find what they're looking for.
How, Dave, how heavily do you rely on paid search marketing versus organic?
Yeah, we certainly, through the course of history, have relied pretty heavily on paid, and I think it's one of the tougher obstacles for us due to bandwidth. I mean, organic search marketing today is, of course, so much more than keyword placement on a page and a few black hat tricks, right? I mean, things are pretty complicated, and it's content-driven. That's the passé phrase to say that content is king, but content really is king. You just can't give that enough credence in this particular business. So paid is a big part of our strategy because we love the quality and the malleability of managing those campaigns and our ability to structure based on return investment. And we have pretty complex models for managing paid search that allow us to throttle budget in and budget out as required.
So and is that all models that you've developed?
Yeah, some internal tools that especially George and I would use to track like on a daily basis. And it gives me lots of budget throttling capability. It's like, yeah, it looks like, okay, things are good today. Things are good today. They're really buying in Ontario, so we'll actually like throttle bid percentages and stuff up at certain times. So
you're monitoring that constantly?
It's a daily grind actually, so which is heavy, but we don't have a lot of people on our team. So when we start to talk about organic, we're doing a pretty good job organically with what we have, and the content that we have, of course, is products. So the first piece of content, we often have a greater vision of what content is, and content comes in so many cool different packages. And content is video and editorial and great articles and stuff you can syndicate and press releases and all that kind of great stuff. Well, we actually have very little of that, but what we do well is serve product. Mm-hmm. Because we have bandwidth to serve product. And if we don't serve product, we don't have anything to sell. So that's kind of the starting place for us. Mm-hmm. So, of course, we rewrite all of that and we optimize all of those products. Probably, I don't know what our SKU count is right now. It's several thousand products, probably 4,000 or 5,000 SKUs that we have on the site today. The next evolution for us to get truly better in organic search is going to be supporting collateral around that. So that video piece that Jamie will shoot about, well, now here's how you buy that down jacket. Yes, we have 200 of them on our website, but you as a consumer are going to have a tough time going through some kind of selection criteria to get to the right one. So we need to build that roadmap and that collateral.
So you're talking about actually having videos demonstrating how to choose.
Video and editorial support for all the categories that we're trying to serve. We're getting into some pretty complex verticals now, right? We've had the luxury of being, you know, largely apparel and outerwear driven for the first 4 years.
Yeah.
But we entered the ski vertical last fall. And that's a complex purchase, and it's an expensive purchase. So if you're going to put down $1,500 on some skis and some boots on a website, you really need to trust that what's going to arrive at your door, regardless of free shipping and free returns, is going to be the product that you want it to get. So there's got to be some kind of product match. Mm-hmm. And it's tougher to deliver that accurately without some kind of content to support, to build my confidence behind the purchase, to build my confidence behind this live out their brand, that these guys seem to know what they're doing, and they know that this pair of skis and this pair of boots is a positive match. It's going to arrive at my door, and I'm going to be able to head out that weekend and have a good experience.
So. Yeah, okay.
The list of, you mentioned, what are some of the obstacles that you're into? I don't know. Why. Is there a list of obstacles we haven't run into? You know, it's the nature of launching a new business. You know,
sure is.
We ran the store and we thought that was a challenge. You think we thought bricks and mortar for you know 5 years before we began investigating this was hard. That is an easy walk in the park. Like running a retail store, that's very simple in comparison to operating an e-commerce company. The sophistication that's required to do this well. Makes running a retail store, and that's not easy. Having a good retail store on many levels is not easy. Running a good e-commerce company has forced our entire team, and George and I, who carry over from the store, it's forced us to be much, much better. It's very hard. It's easy to get started.
Right.
It's very hard to do it well.
Low barrier to entry, high barrier to success.
You couldn't have said it better. That is a perfect way to say it. Which is kind of exciting. That's why I like doing it. It's not the easy thing, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And you think it would be easy. No, it's a real kick in the ass. But the hard thing is the most rewarding thing. And I think this continues to be huge opportunity. If we weren't served in our business by Canadians having more desire to buy online and less options to do it, we would have a very difficult time making our business work. That single factor there, we're solving a problem. gives us the wiggle room to be able to learn how to be in this business. Right. And we're very grateful that we have these market conditions and a patient customer while we learn and figure out how to do this really, really, really well for them.
So this is absolutely the right time to be starting up an e-commerce operation in Canada.
Yeah,
because the market's ready and waiting and eager.
Exactly. We're 4 years into it, so we've got a good head start on things.
Yeah.
But if you were saying to you, what would you say to some other entrepreneur out there? I would say, you know, that e-commerce is a very, very, very important and a big opportunity for you in Canada.
For me, the biggest takeaway from this interview was really the same takeaway that I came away from the conference with, which is I really believe that it is finally Canada's time when it comes to e-commerce. I was intrigued by the way they look at the market, which is there are so few companies that are actually offering anything to Canadians at this point online that if you get in there now, you've got such potential to secure a really strong place in the market. Whether you're a Canadian company, and I certainly hope that a lot of Canadian companies are getting on board now or will very, very soon, or if you're from out of the country and want to reach Canadians, I hate to say it, but at the moment, Canadians are leaving that market pretty wide open for you. So get on in there and get going with it. If you've been listening to this show for a while, or even if this was the first episode you listened to, I'd really love to get some feedback from you about who you are, what kind of business you have, and what inspired you to listen to the show. If you'd be willing to pop me a quick email to Tema, T-E-M-A, at frankonlinemarketing.com, or give me a quick call toll-free at 1-866-544-9262, or head on over to the website or to iTunes or Stitcher and leave some comments. I would really appreciate your feedback. That's all for today. I look forward to chatting with you next week. And in the meantime, I do hope that I'll hear from you. Oh yeah, and if you haven't had a chance to pop on over to the website and check out some of the other episodes or read some of the blog postings, you might want to do that if you've got a few minutes. The website address is frankonlinemarketing.com. Have a great weekend. Bye.